Coming to you live from the basement of an abandoned training facility, where we talk about fighting, training, and events. It's the Fight Mixer Show, where you can hear about all the local and world combat sports happenings. Get ready. It's time to gear up and square up, because we're going live on the Fight Mixer Show.
Thursday, everybody, and nobody's happier than me right now. Gabe, what's going on, brother? How you doing?
Greetings and salutations. Not bad. What's going on?
Nothing too much. So, just a brief disclaimer, we're talking about this before the show aired. Like, Gabe was on the show before he was a co-host. He was actually on the show as a guest. But I was just like, holy shit. Like, what questions do I ask him? And, like, I had all these questions planned, like, row by row. I was going to ask him all these, like, detailed questions. And it was just, like, a Christmas story when Ralphie finally meets Santa Claus. And then I was like, oh, God, what am I going to fucking ask him? And, like, football. Yeah, football. And I was sliding down the slide. I was like, no, I want a red rider BB gun. So I had all these questions, and I missed them all, and now we're going to make up for it. So I can't wait.
Have at it. Proceed.
All right, so a couple of disclaimers. Allie's going to add in questions or her own feedback. She's going to throw in some questions, throw in some comments to the questions that I asked. She's also going to ask questions herself. I have Wikipedia, so I broke my own cardinal rule. Yeah. Wait, what was it? Allie breaking up?
A signal, so we know we're going back and forth.
Perfect. Okay, so laid out a couple of ground rules. I have Wikipedia'd Gabriel's career, just to add like a timeline. I'm also going to bring up some subject matters in the sport of mixed martial arts during one of the greatest eras, one of the most interesting and controversial eras in MMA. Is that right, Gabe?
Definitely an interesting era. I will say that it did start. My first time was in 02, so. I mean, like, I think 94 was the first UFC, so there is definitely a prior history. But the time frame going into it, I got to see the wave from when it was illegal, then it became pseudo-famous into the behemoth it is today. So, yeah, good opportunity to watch the rise of MMA.
Right. So are we all ready to begin? Allie, are you ready?
Yes.
Gabe, are you ready?
All right,
can you hear me? How is it going to fucking start? All right, so let's start off at the top. Let's start off when Gabe became a legend at birth. Gabe was born, brought into the world. You started karate when you were 7 years old. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. Wikipedia is wrong. Really? I did hip keto as a kid. And then I did kung fu as a teenager. Yep.
Right. How did you get involved with mixed martial arts? Because Shudo didn't start until 1986, and UFC didn't start until 1993, with Pancras starting in 1993 as well. So how did you get involved with mixed martial arts or martial arts itself?
So in high school, I'm doing kung fu, and this friend of mine, Sean's like, you got to come over to my house. You got to come watch this thing. It's the most crazy thing ever. And I'm a big martial arts fan. I've been my entire life. I'd watch Kung Fu Theater, Bruce Lee. I mean, Steven Seagal and Jean-Claude Van Damme were all like, when I was growing up a kid, like just like the action heroes that I really enjoyed watching and everything. And so I go to my friend Sean's house, and I think we watched UFC. I believe it was 4. I think it was when Hoist fought Dan Severn. I think that's the correct card. And it was the most insane thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I went to my kung fu sensei and I go, what do you know about grappling? And he lost his mind. Grappling shit is just fucking, he's like, Kung Fu Sansu's got anti-grappling. All right, everyone, and I'm like a young kid, and he's losing his mind. And mind you, he looks like Dave Mustaine from Megadeth. Like this big, tall, like blonde-haired, just like kung fu guy. And he circles up the class and shows an anti-grappling movement. And I'm just like, I'm 16 or 17, and like, I just think it's bullshit. I'm sorry, I just think it's bullshit. Now, obviously, I didn't say that to him, and I went away, moved to San Francisco, and I was 18. I got a tattoo, and my tattoo artist, Troy Denning, he had a Rick Gracie gi in his studio, and I'm like, oh, you train jiu-jitsu? Because at this point, I had bought in every video that I could get my hands on, and you know, I was a massive fan. And he goes, yeah, I trained with Hal Gracie. And I was like, oh my God, I know exactly who that is. I had seen the extreme fighting tapes, and Hal, unlike Hoist, didn't wear a gi, and he threw a lot of punches and was just an animal. And I'm like, okay, well, I want to come training. So he sent me in, and I got beat up my very first day by a little Filipino guy. And I go, how long have you been training for? He's like, 6 months. And I go, I need to learn this shit. So I at the time I was going to college and working full time, and I started the way it was set up is you paid the lowest tier was $100 a month, but that got you one class a week. You basically had four classes a month, and I came in on Monday and I trained my Monday, and then I thought, like, you know what, I may not be able to go and actually do the classes, but I can probably sit and watch them. So I sat and I came in every other day. After the second week, they're like, you know, why aren't you training? And I go, well, I did my one class on Monday and I can't train anymore. And they're like, just get on the fucking mat. And then I really fell in love with fighting and jiu-jitsu, and there was a place called Japan Video in San Francisco, and they had everything. They had the IBCs, they had the Russian tournaments, and I would go there every day, and I'd rent two or three VHS videos, it was all I wanted to do was just train, and it ruined my life because I quit going to college, and just so I could train more jiu-jitsu. And it wasn't that I wasn't like, this is what I'm gonna do for a career. It was more just like, I just love doing this. And I trained for about 4 years, and I started doing kickboxing at Fairtex and a place called Team USA. I did four or five kickboxing fights, and then a San Shao tournament. Went to Japan for a month and a half, trained with some of the top guys there, and I was able to hang with them. And I'm like, okay, let me see if I can fight. And I took a fight. It was WBC, I think, 5 or 6, actually. A buddy of mine set it up for me, and I fought a guy who had already had, like, 15 fights. And I don't care, sure. I just wanted to test to see if I could do it. I fought. I got knocked out, and I go, I want to do it again. I'm going to do it again. I fought a second time. Won that fight pretty easily. And for whatever reason, I got the bite, and that's all I wanted to do. And I did, I think, an 11 or 12 year career, which is insane. But yeah, that was the beginning, the very beginning, 2002.
So I have a question for both you and Allie. And Allie, from a fan perspective, and like me, I have my own opinion, and to Gabe. So, like, the first UFC won. So you watched the first couple of UFCs, and, you know, Hickson Gracie was heavily involved because, you know, the whole concept of UFC was born from the Gracie Challenge. It was widely available. They would bring people in, like, and Gracie would just fucking dollywop all of them. So UFC 1, that was, like, the concept, and also a bunch of executives circle around the fucking Mortal Kombat arcade machines, like, yeah, we got to bring that to national television. And, you know, they got away with it, too, because, you know, I think America had, like, a hunger for violence because Mike Tyson was in jail, so he's no longer killing people. And WWE, like, pro wrestling was kind of, like, on, like, a downturn. So the pro wrestling biz was out. So I think people were craving a new sort of entertainment. But with Hickson Gracie evolved, with the first beginning UFCs.
Hoist.
Well, Hicks and Gracie was behind the scenes. He was like.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And they said Hicks and Gracie. Yeah, I'm sorry. So, like, Hicks and Gracie behind the scenes, Hoist Gracie, the smallest guy of the bunch, fighting everybody, cuts through the competition like hot fucking butter. So, in the tournament, like UFC 1, there were no, like, Olympic wrestlers, no collegiate wrestlers, no other jiu-jitsu black belts. It was just Hoist Gracie. The only thing close to having a ground game was Ken Shamrock. Like, and obviously you caught the bug, and that's what made you want to go into jiu-jitsu. Do you feel that the first beginning UFCs were less of a competition and more just a big, giant fucking infomercial for Gracie Jiu-Jitsu?
So, Allie, you want to hit yours first, then I'll give you my opinion?
Yeah, because mine's not going to be very extensive. I just feel like back then, like, they were just tough fucking dudes. Like, they wouldn't be, like, bitch slapping around now, but technique they have now would have definitely just smoked the whole fucking game. Like, those guys were still tough, but like, they're just tough fucking dudes. Because I remember we had a gym, and it wasn't very technical, and we started getting guys that did a jiu-jitsu camp, which back then, like, nobody took jiu-jitsu, and they just murdered everybody after that. Once they just learned, like, I don't know, a couple weeks worth of jiu-jitsu training, that was it.
So
it was actually Horian who was running things in the background, not Hickson, but Horian expressly set it up perfectly. And he ensured that they picked people that would ensure that his brother got the best matches. And I do feel that in a lot of ways it was an infomercial for jiu-jitsu and an exceptional one. I mean, like, to this day, you know, the Gracie name holds so much weight, a lot of weight. And I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant idea for him to do it that way. But, I mean, they've been doing the Gracie challenge. There's those videos from they've been doing that in their gym. You know, they would do challenge matches in their gym. So they kind of knew that this was going to work and be efficient, especially that, look, I was doing, like, I came from traditional martial arts. I did Kung Fu. And my Kung Fu sensei had me believing that this was the most deadly thing ever, that I was doing Kung Fu Sansu and that it was the baddest martial art on the planet. And if I hit somebody, I would kill them. I genuinely believe that. One thing that I appreciated about Jiu-Jitsu versus that was I learned the first day that what I knew didn't mean anything. The efficiency of Jiu-Jitsu it's changed in my opinion. I think if you ask any historian, they changed the dynamic of martial arts as we know it to this day.
Right. So we also talked about you finding amateur fights. So, like, we also talked briefly about John McCain in the 90s and how he got banned across states and taken off pay-per-view. So yeah. John McCain, I felt, was very hypocritical. On one side, I felt that he helped evolve the sport. But on the other side, I felt like, you know, there was a lot of misconceptions that drove John McCain to get the government to be on MMA's ass like fucking hemorrhoids. Like, when the government's on your ass, like, there's no coming back from that. It's like betting against the house. The house always wins. Like, but John McCain was also at a boxing fight. Like, he says how unsafe it was. But John McCain was also at a boxing fight when somebody died. I think it was like 95 or 96. He also said that, like, it was un-American to hit someone on the ground, but I looked up, I Googled. He said nothing about Ronnie King. You know, like, I think, like, I'm serious. So, like, my question is, was UFC and MMA marketed incorrectly, and that's the reason why it was taken off pay-per-view? Was it unsafe because you also said yourself that you were blown away by it? Or did, you know, hold on, I got the right question. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry about that. So, like, did you feel – not I got the question. I'm sorry. So, like, did you feel that it was just marketing correctly? Did the government not know how to regulate it correctly? Or was it just unsafe and, you know, John McCain had a point? Or – because I don't get it. I really don't get why he took it off. I see why in hindsight, but what do you think, Gabe?
Well, I mean, you got to think of the time frame. And the first UFCs had – as little rules as possible. You could groin strike, you grab the hair. Just optics. The very first fight they had was that I think the Savant fighter versus the sumo wrestler. And the sumo wrestler gets kicked in the face and his teeth fall out of his mouth. The optics of that makes it very easy to be like, no, that's extremely dangerous and it's really, really bad and someone's going to die. My personal feeling is that John McCain was looking for a small niche in his political belt, and he was going after something that didn't have any real weight as far as what's concerning the American people, but he did it to put that little piece into his political belt. That's my personal feeling.
What do you think, Allie?
I agree with that, because I remember the same thing kind of happened in Iowa. I want to say it's 2010 is when they cracked down, and at first they said they were going to do away with all amateur fighting, which ended up happening was they regulated it, which was good, but they were telling us that it was all going to end. There wasn't going to be like any events, because what happened was some 18-year-old kid signed up, and the event that he went to gave him a title holder, and he broke his arm. And the kid actually wasn't even petitioning it. It was his parents, and he had actually wrote a letter saying, I did this on my own choice. I knew the consequences, and I feel like I can face those consequences. I do not think amateur fighting needs to be shut down, but whatever, you know, what happened to me was unfortunate. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was something going on in the state at around the same time, and we all kind of figured this was a huge distraction to try and get people focused away from the big source.
Yeah.
Got it. So, obviously, you fought in the UFC game, and you worked with Dana White. So let's talk about Dana White just for 2 seconds, okay? So the late 90s, early 2000s, Dana White would quit his lucrative job as a box aerobics instructor, because he was a box aerobics instructor, right?
Yeah, that's what he did, yeah.
Right, and he was also a marathon runner from the mob, right?
I mean, you know, Dana has a story. I don't know how much legitimacy is in that, but Dana he did an exceptional job by befriending the Fajita brothers. Who were massive casino magnates, and he got them to invest in the business. And that's a lot of people like if Dana White was the one that Dana just pressed his wealthy friends to invest in a business. I give him all the credit in the world for it, and he's become the face of the UFC. Even where now, when people they go to Dana, Dana doesn't like they talk about matchups. They have matchmakers. You know what I mean? Why Sean Shelby does the matchmaking, but they yell at Dana. And even from my understanding is even now, Dana doesn't have nearly the power that he once did. People think that he's a figurehead and he's paid as a figurehead. But look, I give him all the credit in the world. He has done a very, very good as the spokesman for the UFC. He's done an exceptional job.
So he started managing, like the story has it, and rumor and innuendo, he goes into a jiu-jitsu class for John Lewis. And have you ever met John Lewis, by the way?
Yeah.
What do you think about John Lewis? And how come his UFC career never panned out? Because he was a bad motherfucker. He cornered Chuck Liddell for a while, cornered Tito. How come his UFC career never reached the heights that, you know, he was a bad cat?
Well, John lives out here now and is doing acting and doing, I think, stunt work and things like that. You know what, John even had he had the WFA. If you're a historian of MMA, so you should know about the WFA, which was actually a really fun, cool event that I watched a couple fights with. It was really, really good, fun events. John was kind of a pariah in the jiu-jitsu scene for a while, because he fought Carlson Gracie Jr. In extreme fighting, which kind of put him on, you know, like on the bad guy list of the Gracie family. John fought in the UFC multiple times. I think when Jens knocked him out was kind of the deciding factor that, I don't know what happened after that. The last fight I can remember of John Lewis fighting was he fought Jens in the UFC and got knocked out.
Yeah. Right.
Then he went into the promoting game, but yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so and Dana White has dabbled before. He was a manager of Tito Ortiz and Chuck Liddell when the UFC was in financial peril. He also, little nerd facts, he also was one of the first sponsors of Floyd Money Mayweather. When Floyd Mayweather got out of the Olympics in 96, he was actually a sponsor of Floyd Mayweather. It was a little fucking nerdy fact, but
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's crazy. It was like Burr Bench or some type of fucking sponsor name. I have no idea, but nevertheless, he did sponsor. So you know, it's foreshadowing of events to occur between McGregor and Floyd Mayweather. But nevertheless, so UFC is in financial peril. He's trying to negotiate Tito Ortiz's contract, and then they buy UFC for like $1 million or $2 million, but like...
I believe it was $4
million. $4
million. Well, I don't know the numbers. I do know that one of the Fertitta brothers was on the Athletic Commission, and when multiple people tried to get it legalized in Nevada, it didn't go through, and then when the Fertittas bought the UFC, immediately the Athletic Commission said, yes, we're going to let it happen and we're going to sanction it. It was only sanctioned in New Jersey at that point.
Right. Yeah. It got sanctioned by New Jersey State Athletic Commission, and they got a temp license. And that, like, we're jumping ahead, but that's okay. So Gateway got a temp license. You know, it's okay. New Jersey State Athletic Commission, thanks to one of the guys on the Athletic Commission being an avid martial artist and a fan who actually got it. So they regulated the rules and everything like that. The first event under the Zupa banner was at Trump Taj Mahal. And Tito Ortiz would beat like a much smaller Evan Tanner in the main event. Jens Pulver would beat Carlo Uno in your weight class for the belt. So what was your opinion? Talk about Jake Paul. So what was your opinion? You know, it's 2001. It's a year before your pro debut. Were you watching the first events in New Jersey? Like, were you tape trading? Were you finding a way to watch these events? Or were you keeping up in the MMA scene to see your weight class and also see what was going down?
Well, first off, it wasn't my weight class. I had no idea that I was going to fight professionally. That was never anything that I thought about. But I was a massive fan. And I mean, so I was talking about this earlier, and someone's bringing up the Jake Paul thing. I have no problem bringing up that piece of shit later. But let's proceed with what we're going at right now. We would go to – I'd watch every event that was possible. I remember watching Tito Ortiz versus Frank Shamrock at a sports bar. There's one sports bar in the entire city of San Francisco that would have events. And we watched it there. I was such a fan that I would – anything I could get my hands on, I would get a hold of. And if there was an event, I would absolutely watch the event. I watched basically anything that I could. And, again, this is pre-internet, so it wasn't – like I said, I would say that the number one place was Japan Video. That place had everything. And that was kind of my go-to. But if there was an event that was being televised, we would watch it live. Me and all the guys from House Gracie's team, we would go. It was like a big deal for us to go watch these fights. As far as like all the fights that they had, anything that they had televised, we were watching them.
Right. And UFC's return to pay-per-view was September 2001. And as history would show, that was the second worst thing to happen to America in September 2001. I mean, UFC victory in Vegas was a terrible event. But not, you know, the September 11th attacks and everything like that. Where were you during the attacks, and where were you at the stage of your life and your career?
Okay, well, so we watched my friend Rob and Kathy went to their house to watch the UFC event. And you are right, it was a very bad event. And Vlady Matashenko was a good close friend of mine, took the fight against Tito Ortiz because someone backed out. I don't remember who backed out. But
Vitor Belfort.
Okay. Now, the one thing I was actually impressed with about that fight is that Tito out-wrestled Vlady, because Vlady, it was such a gangster wrestler at that point. And it was a boring, boring fight. But the fact that he was able to do that was kind of impressive. 9-11, I was actually I got up for work. I was working at a hospital at the time. And I woke up and I actually turned on the news and – they were talking about the first tower, and I watched the second tower actually get hit. And I had just gotten out of the Coast Guard maybe 3 months prior to that. And so I called my duty station. I said, are we being activated? What's happening? They're like, we have no idea what's happening. We'll call you if we need you. But, you know, as of right now, you're on just a standby basis. And that was I never got called up for that. But, that was 9/11, which was very, very intense to actually watch. The second tower hit the building was unbelievable.
Right. So UFC not being successful, and by the way, a little tidbit on 9/11, United 93, the one plane that did not make its destination, Jeremy Glick, Judoka national champion, was on that plane that helped take the plane down. So you know, if MMA can tip their hat, and obviously it's a thing of pride, but if MMA can tip their hat to one person, you know, it's Jeremy Glick, who was a judo national champion, who was on that plane to help bring the plane down. But nevertheless, UFC victory in Vegas, you know, the pay-per-view did like about 75,000 buys, and from September 2001 to January 2002, the buys would go from 75K all the way down to, like, I think it was like 30K, or like the audience wasn't buying. Do you think that people were just not in the mood to invest again? Because, you know, making a second impression to the UFC, do you think it just wasn't branded correctly, wasn't marketed correctly? People just weren't buying, or just wasn't in the mood to embrace this new sport with everything going on?
It's difficult. I think that when they made that first foray into pay-per-view and it was kind of a sinker, I think that, like, so, like, for anytime you want to start something new, you want it to be an explosion. You want it to come out the gate hot, right? And unfortunately, it was not. It was very lackluster. And I think that probably had a good part of it. And then you know, then you're doing kind of a rebuilding after that. You know, I kind of watched the evolution. I went to a lot of live events and Ultimate Fighter. And it seemed like even before the Ultimate Fighter, there was this slow buildup of, the events were good. And I was talking about, at that time frame, actually, the WFA, the John Lewis promotion, they had it great to where you go to Vegas and you would go to the UFC one night, then the next night would be WFA. And it was like a fight weekend, and it was a lot of fun. And you kind of felt that there was a little bit of energy, but it wasn't like it was going to be. But I will say this: that the core fans that were there from the beginning are the most fanatical and amazing fans, and a group of now. I can distinctly remember going to a UFC fight and listening to some dipshit tell his buddy that it was Gann McGee versus someone. I can't remember who else he was fighting, but I distinctly remember that fight. He was like, my buddy Bubba, he beat some guy up and threw him on a couch just like that bitch. And we're sitting there like, these guys are UFC fans, but we had no idea that there'd be more. And that group of people would just keep growing and growing and growing. And the grassroots would be dying off. But you still felt the synergy. There was definitely – there was going to be a buildup. But, I mean, obviously, we didn't think it would be what it is – ever what it is today.
Like, do you have, like, a little bit of envy that you're in it on the rise and not when it already had peaked?
You know what? No. The reality is when I go back to the reason why I fought the first time, I did it because I was terrified of fighting. I didn't do it because I wanted to be famous. I didn't do it because I wanted to be a badass. I didn't do it. I did it because it was something that terrified me. I was exhilarated watching it, and there was a certain terror of doing it. So for me, actually, to be honest, the Ultimate Fighter, I think, was the worst thing that ever happened to me, because I got it in my head that I was like, oh, I'm going to be famous, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, instead of the real reason why I fought in the first place. I think that the fame and money, in my personal opinion, ruins the purity of it.
Right.
Do you see that in other fighters that you think they lost why they started it, and now they got famous, and it's just now they're kind of in all sorts of different directions. They're not focused on their fighting or their career. Now it's, can I get on this commercial? Can I get this brand?
I think I've seen a complete dynamic change. Like we were talking about that like per the, I don't know, the Facebook user brought up Jake Paul. That guy shouldn't be talked about at all. The fact that guy is being brought up, and like, look, he has marketed himself the way he has. The fact that people like that have the ability to become famous, that disgusts me.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck Jake Paul. So like, and you brought up your first professional fight, which was a year later, October 2002, for the WEC. And you mentioned like how you lost. Was it nerves? Was it just you were terrified when you first got in there? Because a year later in 2003, you know, you ended the guy in the first round. So, like, was it just nerves, or was it just, you know, cold feet for your first time stepping in the cage, or?
I had bronchitis. My good friend Dan Camarillo had to unfortunately share a room with me as I was coughing and hacking the whole night before the fight. You know what? I was green as hell, and I was sick as shit. I took Sam down, and I had mount, and that was about all I had in the fight. As soon as he got out of it, I had nothing left. I think I threw a lazy leg kick, and he cracked me and ended it. But I feel like at that point in my fighting career, that probably would have happened anyways. It just probably would have happened a little bit later in the fight. Yeah.
Okay. So, and we brought up a topic, and we always talk about Tito Ortiz. So let's just crack on him a little bit. So, like, back in the early days, obviously from his win against Evan Tanner, and then he fought against Elvis Sinistick, and he beat Elvis Sinistick, and he was given pretty much layups. And then, you know, he fought against Vladimir Matyushenko, the janitor. And you know, obviously the writing was on the wall that Tito Ortiz was going to be the face of the company. He was obviously going to be what UFC makes The Rock or Stone Cold Steve Austin. That was going to be the figurehead. So what were your first impressions? Because you met Tito Ortiz at WEC, correct?
Yeah. I don't care about anybody. Like I that is one thing I like anyone that I've met, like even so, like there are people that I'm inspired by and that I think are exceptional martial artists. Like the first time I met Anderson Silva, like I he's someone that, but I'm not going to, I don't care who the hell you are. But I was fighting in the WEC and I was introduced to Tito, and Tito's like, "Hey, how you doing? I'm Tito Ortiz." He used like I'm supposed to know who you are, and like your only reason why you're putting your last name is because you feel that you are somebody. And I was just like, "You're a douchebag." You're like from the first get-go. And again, this is, he's not even, well, I used to be the UFC champion at that point, but like you introduced yourself as Tito Ortiz, like fuck off. Really, he was a douchebag then and nothing has changed. He's just if you can fit any more douche into that bag. Tito has done his best to try to like add more douche. He's just like that. That's an overfilled douchebag. That guy.
It's a douchebag plus.
It's seeping over that fucking guy. Yeah.
So before we talk about the fact that he's getting removed from city council and being a mayor for a vote of confidence, because we were talking and laughing about that before. So 2002, obviously you're coming off your first fight and then coming back in 2003 strong. And getting a whole row of wins, we're going to talk about that. Tito Ortiz, UFC Vendetta, UFC who's been doing bad business all year long, finally gets a shot in the arm. Ken Shamrock, coming off WWE fame, comes into UFC, did Ken Shamrock versus Tito Ortiz for an old rivalry that took place if Tito Ortiz beat Guy Mesner and Gary Bolander and all that fucking fun stuff. So Tito Ortiz, and they build up Tito Ortiz versus Chuck Liddell. Tito Ortiz, if he was going to be the figurehead, he was going to pass the torch to Chuck Liddell because Dana White knew that Chuck Liddell was going to beat that ass. So, nevertheless, Tito Ortiz beats Ken Shamrock. Ken Shamrock, who just is coming off a loss to Don Fry. Tito Ortiz is coming off from a one-year layoff. At the end of the fight, he says, "I really don't want to think about that right now because, you know, me and Chuck, we have some things we got to talk about. Money, blah, 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 movie commitments." The age-old question, and going around the MMA community like you have, was Tito Ortiz ducking Chuck Liddell?
100%. 100%. In training, Chuck beat that ass easily. I talked to many, many people. Now, I've never been in the room with either one of those gentlemen. I will say that. But I know many, many people that have been in the room with both of them. And everyone that I've talked to said that Tito could not do anything to Chuck. And a lot of the times, he would back away from Chuck because Chuck would be beating him up so bad. So it was 100% a duck. And no one wants to transfer, you know, power. And the thing is, look, no disrespect to Ken, even though it might sound disrespectful, but Ken, his heyday had passed many, many moons ago when he fought Tito. And him fighting Ken twice means dick all. That's as much as Matt Hughes beating Hoist. Like, really, like, I have utmost respect for Hoist. I actually trained with Hoist for the Matt Hughes camp, and I was like, he's going to get dusted. But Tito kept beating up Ken in one of those fights because they were easy fights for him to win. And he did not want to fight Ken. He didn't want to fight Chuck. Because he didn't want to pass the torch. But the reality is, Chuck gave the UFC what they needed. They wanted a knockout artist. They wanted someone that would come in there and crack people. And that's the reality. Like, that's what Chuck brought to the table.
Gotcha. So let's fast forward. Ali, do you have any comments, by the way?
No, I'd itch my eye.
Okay, hold up your finger because I'm going to go fucking nerd crazy. So hold up your finger. I apologize. So now we're going to fast forward to 2003. This was a fucking huge year for you because, you know, coming off a loss, and we're going to go right and skip to 2003. Sorry, I actually took notes. So second pro fight happened in February 2003 for the Gladiator Challenge. TKO win in 1 minute. What did you change in the last 4 months from your first fight to the second fight? What did you work on? Who did you train with? How did you make such vast improvements from your first fight into your second fight? And I know with bronchitis and sicknesses and everything like that, but what did you work on that there was such a great improvement? And also summer 2003, you also had two big wins as well, all first round finishes. Like, what changed?
Well, I mean, you got to understand that that time frame, we didn't really know what MMA is for, like. So I would do jiu-jitsu at one club. I'd go to do kickboxing in another club. And then I would do MMA sparring at the jiu-jitsu club. We didn't really have an idea of, like, and then I would go to the gym and I would do, you know, I would do buys and legs on one day and back and chest on the other day. Like, I didn't really have a real idea of what it took for training at that point. I just went back to training and, you know, I will say that we trained really, really hard at that point. We sparred a lot. That if there's one thing about that time frame is you every session was basically you were fighting. Like you know you'd go to an MMA practice and all that was is okay, we beat the fuck out of each other for an hour. I don't think there's anything different about it, to be honest. I felt like I needed to get a fight back because I really felt that I didn't get to show what I had. And I also felt that I think that's the only difference, to be honest. I can't think of anything that was like, I'm going to change things up. At that point, I had no concept of changing anything up. And to be honest, I felt like I'm going to fight that fight and that fight's going to be it. Because the first fight, I felt like the bronchitis played a part in it. And the reality is maybe the first fight, if I would have won that might have been it. But then again, I don't know because it was there's something exhilarating about it. There's something primal and very real about fighting that I can't explain to someone that has never done it.
Right. So skipping ahead to 2004, and Ali, just hold up your finger when you want to have a comment. So, by the way, we're going to fast forward because obviously we want to run out of time, and I don't want to run out of time. So, like, skipping ahead to 2004, and before that, you know, T-Ortiz finally comes back. Randy Couture spanks that ass. I'm sure Gabe was very, very happy, and the MMA community was happy about that. Beautiful. And before that, Chuck Liddell fighting Randy Couture, they considered Randy Couture to be washed up. Like, he lost to Rico Rodriguez at heavyweight. He lost to Josh Barnett at heavyweight. So I have no idea why they would consider Randy Couture to be a layup for Chuck Liddell, because obviously they were trying to pass the belt to Chuck Liddell to fight Tito Ortiz and corner him. And, like, you met Randy Couture, correct?
Yeah, you know what? My second fight ever, Nate Quarry was on the same card as I was, and Randy Couture cornered Nate at Gladiator Challenge, and that's the first time I met him, and he was a super nice guy. Randy's I'm very, very fortunate that I've actually met up with Nate Quarry on a number of occasions past that. My second fight ever, Randy Couture, and this is at a podunk Indian casino in the middle of nowhere in Porterville. Randy Couture was cornering Nate Quarry.
Awesome. So yeah. In 2004, big year for you. You had a TKO win over Cody Reeds at IFC. Then a submission win to earn a UFC world title shot 2 months later against a crafty Pride and MMA veteran and BJJ black belt Olef Alfonso. You won the Arena Rica choke to win your first world title. And winning your first world title, was it gratifying knowing the journey that you started all those years ago finally paid off? You had this world title. And, you know, how did it feel like being on top of a division in the WEC?
Well, the WEC wanted Olaf to be the champion. I mean, if you've ever seen Olaf fight, he is a wild man. And he's like, his nose is over here because he throws with reckless abandonment. And If you want to see just like a rock'em sock'em bloodfest, him versus John Palakowski in the WC is one of those fights. Where just like they just sit in front of each other, punching each other in the face, and they wanted Olaf to win, and he had just beaten a couple guys who were really good, but they wanted Olaf to be the face of the WC because he had lost a decision to Gil Melendez. And he, who was actually the first 55-pound champion, and so they wanted Olaf to be the champion, and taking him out and becoming the champion was kind of surreal. You have to understand that I didn't start this to be a champion. I didn't start this to make it a career. I did it because I was afraid. You know what I mean? And to become a champion of the WC, and especially at that time frame, I was just in complete shock. I had broke my hand in the fight, and I had torn my cornea, and I was in pain, but I was also just on cloud nine.
Awesome. So you're now the world champion, and meanwhile in the UFC, because your careers are going to cross paths shortly. So meanwhile in the UFC, Tito Ortiz finally fights Chuck Liddell in a long-awaited duel. How happy were you when you saw Tito Ortiz get dropped by Chuck Liddell finally?
I was there live, actually, and it was a thing of beauty. At that point, I think there's two fights in my mind for UFC that and they're actually both Chuck Liddell that I saw live that like the aura in the room was just out of control. And I gotta say, Chuck versus Tito and Chuck versus Vanderlei are two live shows that you felt the whole place was just on fire. And when Chuck knocked out Tito, oh, it was gratifying.
Did you see the part where Tito Ortiz threw his hat in the crowd and they threw it right back, by the way?
I did remember that, yes. And I loved it. Oh, God, yeah.
I
unequivocally a Tito hater, okay? And really, like, genuinely, I'm a Tito hater. I have no problem saying that. And it's like, I don't want ill will for him. I don't want his family to suffer. But I just don't like that guy at all.
Right. Yeah. And another like little nerd question. So like, this is the first time I saw like celebrities in the crowd. Like George Clooney was in the crowd, apparently. Michael Clark, God rest his soul, and Juliette Lewis. So, you know, celebrities are finally getting on the bandwagon. And then I did my research. You were actually in a video, and I told my girlfriend about this. You were in a video with Paris Hilton. Is that correct?
Oh, that was real?
Yeah, I did. I worked with Paris privately for about, three or four lessons.
Privately.
The one lesson, there was one particular lesson where she's like, oh, you know, I want to do it at this park, and there might be paparazzi there. And I got there and they had everything already set up. And I'm like, okay, this is express. You have this set up in advance. Like, this is not impromptu like you're pretending it is. And it actually made quite a stir. I mean, I'm half German, half Russian Jewish descent. My German relative sent me magazines from Germany, the gossip magazines of a two-page layout of me holding bats for Paris. But yeah, so I did I think three or four private sessions with her.
Does she naturally talk like that, or does she fake it?
Talk like a moron? No, that's real.
No, like the squeak voice.
I don't know about a squeak voice. She's just a fucking idiot. Look. The takeaway from that is she paid me $350 an hour. I do about maybe 15 minutes of pad holding for her, and then she would like talk to her assistant or play with her stupid little dog, I gotta do something else. And I mean, at that point, like, pay me $350 an hour. I as a matter of fact, I take that back. Paris, if you're watching this video, which you're not. I take back what I said. You are a brilliant, brilliant woman. And if you want to work again, hit me up.
My girlfriend and I got into this big Oh, I'm sorry, Allie. What were you saying? I'm so sorry for interrupting you.
No, I just
talking about the inflation. It's 450.
Yeah, that was a long time ago, and money is different now.
Yeah, that's true. Good point. Good point.
My girlfriend was having this conversation with me that Paris Hilton is actually smart, and she's a crappy businesswoman, and we're having this conversation. So my girlfriend's probably watching. So love you. So let's go.
No, I will say this: she is not smart. Now, look. She's done an exceptional job of marketing herself. And look, who is she? She's just a rich girl. Nothing else. Like there's, you know. And look, Kim Kardashian. Her being friends with Kim Kardashian, and then Kim Kardashian having a sex tape, blew up Kim. So like in reality, like if you're gonna go into it, I mean, Kim Kardashian should be thanking Paris for, you know, sucking that D on the film.
She paved the way for the rest of them.
Bingo.
Groundbreaking.
All right, my girlfriend's going to beat my ass. So let's switch subjects back to you, Gabe. Okay, so like 2005 was a very successful year for Mr. Gabe. Two successful title defenses in the WEC. An armbar win in King of the Cage. So Sam Welch ended your streak of finishes, won that fight by decision. Why was he such a tough fight? You know, you were going on this hot streak of just finishing people. What made him such a tough fight, and what, well, like?
So Sam is my loss, my first loss.
Right.
So, and Sam is really, really tough. And actually, I'm still friends with Sam. I've seen him at UFC events back in the day. He's a tough, tough dude. He's one of those, he'd be considered a journeyman, but like Sam's just a tough dude. The first round, I was winning decisively. The second round, he dropped me. I had to fight back hard. And then the third round, I did everything in my power to finish him. I just could not do it. And, I mean, it was a good fight. And I think the best part about it was, up to that point, I think I was finishing fights pretty fast. So I never had an opportunity to really see what, like, inner fortitude I had. And Sam, he brought it, man. He Sam's an unsung hero in the respect that, like, you know, mainstream fans aren't going to know who Sam Wells is. But there are a lot of guys out there that are genuinely tough, tough, badass dudes that on any given day can beat you.
Right. So now we're going to go to – finally, the UFC makes some headway, goes mainstream. The Fighter Season 1 aired on Spike TV. What was your overall opinions on the show, the announcement that MMA was going to take the reality TV route? I have my own opinions. I thought that it was a good – for educational purposes on the sport, but not enough fights. Also, I didn't like the goofy, let's highlight Chris Lieben drinking, and like, I didn't like that shit. Nevertheless, it's not about me. So like, going to you, what was your overall opinions about it? And what was the MMA community like? Because we know that it all fits in.
I remember hearing about like who they had casted, and there's a lot of like, who? You know what I mean? Like, as far as like at that point, that time frame of MMA fighters, like there are a lot of guys now that have since become like, I think Forrest Griffin was the one name that I had heard because he had done IFC tournament.
IFC.
But overall, and I knew Nate because you know him and I had fought on my second fight ever. But like I watched Chris Lieben's fight, so I knew who he was because he fought Mike Swick. But there are a lot of guys like Diego Sanchez and Kenny Florian and. And there are a lot of guys that we still don't even know. Like Chris Sanford, I actually became friends with later, but there are a bunch of guys to this day that I still, you know, can't remember who they are. But outside of the casting, being like kind of confused about the casting, I thought it was great because, I mean, you know, the opportunity for any exposure at that point was a good thing. I certainly didn't think that it was going to be the catalyst that it was. You know, I mean, I remember watching the finale and being like, oh, like those are good fights, especially the Forrest Griffin, Stephen Bonner fight, and being like, that was a fucking great fight. But I didn't think it was going to do what it did. And, I mean, it fucking blew up.
Strange Brew, I had a theory about Strange Brew that they brought in. So Strange Brew was this guy that they randomly brought in, this guy from Canada. He had apparently smoker fights. They did very well, and they brought him in. And he's kind of like a fish out of water. He ended up fighting Chris Lieben at the finale. Chris Lieben lit him up. I thought Chris, like Strange Brew and some of the guys that they brought in was just to show what's the difference between an Ultimate Fighter and what's the difference between like just regular Joe Schmo? Do you agree? Do you disagree?
I think that they wanted to put together a cast, and one thing that I learned from going for the Ultimate Fighter myself is that's what they're doing. They're not like the fighting is a part of it, obviously, but they're bringing in like it's a show. They want the entertainment factor. So when we had Chris on the show, about 3 weeks ago, Chris was saying that they wanted him immediately. He's a character. Of course they wanted him on there. I'll be honest. When I was on the Ultimate Fighter, there are other people that had their way of getting on. I sat down with the producer for coffee, and she was just like, I'm going to tell you, like, you're not going to do anything else. You're going to go through the whole process with everybody, but you're pretty much already there because you're a personality. And that's what they want, you know, more than like the fighting is secondary, really. And I mean, don't get me wrong. There are some fucking exceptional fighters that have come from the Ultimate Fighter. And my season, I feel that we had a really solid, good grouping of fighters. But it's TV. So TV is far more important than the actual aspect of fighting.
Right. So, and Ali, do you have any questions? I'm so sorry for picking up.
No, it's fine. I know you're in your own itinerary. But, yeah, and I can totally see Gabe's point where it's a problem because, yeah, they want a personality on there. And then these guys that already have that douchebag personality, it just gets even more inflated. Like, this show wants me. I must be such a great athlete. And it just blows their head up even more. And all reality was they're like, you're a fucking idiot. And people are going to want to see what you say.
More or less. I mean, so – like so an interesting a caveat to the whole Ultimate Fighter. So they put us in a van when I went. You do medical tests, and the guy driving the van is actually he's one of the producers, and he's sitting there watching us and interview. Like he's just pretending like he's just driving us, but in reality, he's seeing us how we interact. He's like, "Oh, those two guys fucking hate each other. Those two guys are talking shit. These two guys are this and that." They're actually driving us around. One of the producers is driving us around. We don't know at the time. We just think it's the driver, right? And so he's doing his background to figure out who's going to fit into the house to make controversy, to make things good. Like, for instance, Matt Wyman and I, we hated each other from the bus. We hated each other because he started talking shit about a couple of close friends of mine. And I wanted to fight him right there, right then and there. And so there was already a rift. So they're like, yeah, we're going to get these two guys in the house because they're going to hate each other. Of course. Why wouldn't you?
Unbelievable. And by the way, around the end of 2006, before we get into 2005, actually, before we get into 2006. So Chuck Liddell finally winning the UFC light heavyweight championship. It was one of the biggest buy rates in UFC history at that time. It was the biggest. Brief question. Did you ever meet Chuck Liddell? Did you ever have an interaction with him?
Yeah, I've met Chuck many times.
Cool. Awesome.
Yeah, you know, I have nothing bad to say about Chuck. The only bad thing I will say about Chuck is I wish he would not have taken that last fight against Tito. I felt that was criminal. That was criminal by his training partners and the commission and anyone that allowed that fight to happen. Outside that, I hold Chuck in a high regard.
Right. And just to put it in perspective, Gabe's generation, Forrest Griffin and I, we met in 2013. I sat down with Forrest Griffin. I was talking to him about his fights in the IFC, like his fights with Dan Severin. And he didn't even know what the fuck I was talking about. He didn't even remember until like I showed him my phone. So, you know, this generation, Gabe's generation, fought through fucking wars, period. So I just wanted to add that tidbit. So now we go on to 2006. We would face a tough task. Talk to me about the Hermes Burroughs fight.
Hermes Franca?
Franca, yeah.
I felt ready to step up and I wanted to fight. I kept the WBC. So they'd asked me to fight Jason Maxwell, who just knocked out Jens Pulver. And he was like, people are going to believe this, but I hope they believe it. But Jens Pulver was the number one fighter in the world at that point. And yep. Jason Maxwell knocked him out. So I beat Jason. And they're like, your next person has to be a name. And I said, fine, give me a name. I'm perfectly okay to test myself and see where I'm at. And they threw out Hermes. And I said, yeah, that's a good fight. Let's go. I'd watched tape on Hermes, but apparently Hermes uh, at that at the tape that I watched, he wasn't motivated. And apparently he decided to really step it up, and he was training with Kurt Pellegrino and a bunch of other tough guys. And he came prepared, and I felt like I could do it. And it was not my night. He clipped me. And a couple things. This is the first California commission fight for the WEC. And the fight right before me, Rob McCullough fought Olaf Alfonso and killed him. Not literally, but like hit him, dropped him, and then got on top of him and just fucking drilled him in the face. The commission was like, if anything else happens, so to give you pull back a little bit, I'm warming up, I'm already in like the doing my getting ready for my walk, and Rob knocks out Olaf, and it is a bad knockout where the commission comes in, the EMTs come in. I'm sitting in the cold waiting for the fight to happen. And this is not me making any excuse for the fight. This is just me telling you what happened. It took us probably about 20 minutes before they allowed the fights to keep happening. And the commission said, if there's one more thing like this, we're calling the whole show. And so the WEC says, I went into the fight. Josh Rosenthal was the ref, who's a good ref and a good friend of mine. And Hermes dropped me, and Josh admittedly said that he rushed in. I felt I could have kept fighting. I got dropped, and who knows? He probably could have done more damage to me. But it absolutely he rocked me, and then he went on a run that got him to the UFC title. He beat Nate Diaz after me. He beat three or four other guys before fighting Sean Sherk and losing for the UFC title. So, I mean, it was Hermes on fire, and I wasn't as ready as I should have been, and that's just what it was, you know? On that day, but I will say this. That is one of the fights I regret the most, because Hermes turned out to be a pedophile and a rapist, and the fact that I lost that piece of shit, Sean Sherk, piece of shit.
Right, and Hermes got put away for, I think it's like 4 or 5 years, and they got deported back to Brazil. Yeah. So, Justin Sims, I love you, brother. And he asked, what's your, you know, we're running out of time. We got 3 minutes left. I was about to get to your UFC debut. So, obviously, we've got to wrap it up and get to part two. This close. So, Justin Sims, I love you. That's a great question. He was asking, what's your favorite thing and least favorite thing about me, Matt, and Justin Sims? So,
the thing I miss the most, or the thing that I have the biggest issue with, is that Justin Sims, who's the one who's like, hey, you want to do this podcast? He doesn't do it anymore. And I miss that guy. I miss him so much. It hurts me every night. I go to sleep crying to my wife. Like, I need Justin Sims back in my life, but he doesn't want me anymore. And I feel like a dejected girlfriend that's just been thrown to the side.
Like a used shop rag.
Like he talked you into moving and then dumped you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. So, we're 2 minutes. We're running out of time. So obviously, I wanted to get into your win against Sabin Yun, and then going into your UFC debut. Obviously, we gotta say this for part two, because I got Gabe. I was so excited. I was at fucking work. I was typing this up. I got all the way up to 2013. So like literally chronologically ordered this entire fucking thing. I was that excited.
So this could be like a three-parter.
Three-parter.
let me answer the question from the Facebook. Jake Paul is a joke. I have actually had a couple students that have gone and trained with him, very low-level guys, and they bring in people from the Valley to be his sparring partner to build his confidence, and they make him sign a non-disclosure contract. And if they do good with him, they throw the footage away, and if they do bad against him, they utilize the footage. Jake Paul is a little piece of shit, and if it was up to me, I would smash his face right now. And he has no option. He, like, the fact that he is making money and that people even talk to him, that I'm being asked a question about that guy, drives me fucking insane.
Right. And the fact that Jake Paul is the biggest piece of shit of all time. And by the way, you can add his mom at Pam/Stepnik. You can add up his mom, because he fucking added Ben Askren's wife and started harassing her. Like, he's the biggest shit. So, I hope he gets his fucking ass kicked. Fuck Jake Paul. Biggest piece of shit. Did not earn it. He fucking got to the main event, never knowing what the fuck talent means. Fuck that guy. Fuck that piece of shit.
So this is going to be a boxing match, right?
Correct.
Fuck that piece of shit. Fuck that guy.
And he's got somebody that knocked out Ben with a knee training him for boxing.
I mean, makes sense to me. But look, that guy, he's not real. He's doing this expressly for likes and for like, look, we've gotten to the age where that is more important than actual fighting. And look, on the other side, he's making way more money than I ever made in any fight that I had. So I mean, what can I say? You know what I mean? Like, being a joke, he's making way more money than I ever made in my fight. So, you know what? Slow clap for Jake Paul.
That's the thing with some of these guys. They're getting by just being obnoxious shitholes, and they're making grudge matches because nobody actually wants to put them on a card until they find a real fighter and poke at them until that fighter says, hey, match me up with them. I'm tired of him talking shit, and that's how they can get on cards. So, I mean, they're marketing themselves in their own way because they're just shit fighters that can't get on cards.
Yeah, well, the thing, I think one of my least favorite things is these shit fighters that talk about, like, oh, this guy is ducking me, this guy's ducking me. You're irrelevant, and you're going to get knocked out whatever fight you have, and then you're going to go to obscurity. But like, this is what you do, and this is how you build yourself up. And you know what? What the fuck can I do? I'm a 43-year-old man that runs a school, and I don't really, I'm involved in MMA, but I'm not involved in it anymore. But if we were going to say that, I feel like going back from fighting where fighting was real and raw and pure to what we are now, all of the fame, all of the money, it's all for naught, to be honest.
Right. And so we're going to time this out, and I'm going to make this a nice leeway to part two, because Gabe and that entire generation, the reason why I wanted to talk to Gabe in the first place, because it's my fucking favorite generation of MMA, they didn't fight for Instagram likes. Didn't fight for Facebook. There was no Facebook, no Instagram. Maybe MySpace, like Zanga. I don't know, some other fucking shit. But they fought for fucking glory, and they put the spore on their fucking back. These guys fighting wars after wars that most of these little motherfuckers like Jake Paul never fucking watched, never studied, and never fucking idolized like I fucking did. And these little motherfuckers don't know what it's like to fight throughout the entire journey. Fight the entire journey, go through the process, and, you know, you are a perfect example. You had no social media whatsoever. You fought for the love of the game, and maybe you would land on television, which you fucking did because you deserved it. So, final words. I hope I wrap that up like a Christmas present correctly. I hope so.
I hope it gave someone some insight into that time period. I have no problem talking about it. It's fun for me. There are people that are far better fighters than I am that are icons in the sport. I was talking to you about this earlier, but if I give this game some insight to some people, then I have no problem doing part two. But it's always fun talking to you guys, and yeah, that's pretty much it for me.
Fuck yeah! Final thoughts, Alan.
I'm glad to be a part of it and learn more about Gabe, because I mean, I didn't realize how long of a history Gabe had in the sport. I'm not as an encyclopedia as David is, and I'm glad I got to sit in this. I learned quite a bit, and it was actually interesting.
So,
David's like, what about this tweet you made in the year 2005?
I loved it. I fought this sport my entire life, and Gabe was a big part of it. And again, I was starstruck. The first time, Matt was like, oh, fucking Gabe Willigard is going to be your fucking, Godzilla is going to be your fucking co-host. I'm like, I'm not qualified to fucking be like Gabe being my co-host, like no fucking way. Like, so I was completely starstruck. Our first interview, I apologize. So that for months I've been itching. I'm like, Gabe would send me stories and he would talk about the Gracies and talk about his stories on the road, like partying with NFL players and fucking these after parties. I'm like, Gabe, we have to do a fucking Ask Gabe episode. I have to ask.
All right, side note, Gabe, blink twice if you're starting to feel a little uncomfortable around David now.
I'm just glad that there's two coats between us. That's comfortable for me. That there's this whole midsection that keeps dipping away.
Fair enough, sir. Fair enough. So, we're going to wrap this up.
I want to know.
Join us for part two. In 2 weeks, me and Matt are going to be down in Florida covering BCFC. I'm going to be down in Florida with Matt. We're going to be interviewing all the players. It's going to be fucking awesome. Part two will be coming in 2 weeks. And also join Ali's show, the A show, next Wednesday. It's going to be awesome. So,
ladies and gentlemen. You guys can come on our show, too.
Wait, what?
You guys can come on our show, too. I'm just always kind of like sitting in on your guys's.
All I have to do is ask. You don't understand. Like, I'm nobody. Are you kidding me? All I have to do is ask me. I'll say yes. Not like what else am I going to do? Matt looks like he wants to talk this whole time, though. Go ahead, Matt.
On a second episode, I definitely want to find out more about your gym and how you started it and more of what's going on there.
Fuck yeah. Happy to talk about that. I love that shit. That's my jam, son.
I like how your whole like start was kind of more like a spiritual journey of just like getting over your fear of fighting, and then it just kind of like skyrocketed.
I mean, that's the truth of it. I mean, I wish that. The time period is a time frame. It was illegal. I had to fight on an Indian reservation. I couldn't fight in a real, sanctioned bout that anyone knew about. So yeah, it was a different animal, different time frame, different animal.
Awesome sauce. So from Matt, the producer, Ali, my MMA crush Monday, Gabe, we'll see you for part two of the episode in about 2 weeks. Ladies and gentlemen, signing up from the Fight Mixer. Peace out.
Bye con Dios.
Perfect.